to Too Many RPGs, a show about RPG shows. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Ethan. This is a show where we talk to creators and fans of actual play podcasts and streams about why they enjoy them. Hey, Lauren.
Yeah.
It's come up. What would your giant mech robot look like?
This has come up quite often, hasn't it?
Mechs? Yeah.
Yeah. Turns out people who play RPGs really like giant mechs.
I think secretly everyone loves giant robots.
I don't know. I don't know how I feel about giant robots. I'm not, like, anti-giant robot, but...
I'm less humanoid giant robots and more, like, weird-shaped giant robots.
Yeah. I think I would like a giant... God, I don't know. Like, a giant ball, I guess, but one where I don't get dizzy with it spinning around.
Okay. Would it have, like, legs, or does it just float?
I feel like it floats, because if it has legs, it gets too much into spider territory. But maybe it has arms.
You know what's funny is I was thinking a giant ball, but with giant spider legs.
Yeah, of course you were. I know what you're about.
When did my brand become spiders?
I don't know, but it is.
Where'd all these spiders come from?
I don't know. What about...
Why did they keep coming out of me?
Where in your past did spiders have such an effect on you?
Where did the spiders come from?
Ethan, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Are you the Spider-Man?
And this week we're talking to Bren about their new podcast, Whispers in the Shade.
Hello, Bren. How are you?
Hi, I'm very good. Just finished recording an episode and very excited to be doing a thing.
We are excited to have you to do this thing. So tell us, what is Whispers in the Shade?
Whispers in the Shade is an actual playtest podcast wherein myself as GM and my three friends Takuma, Kai, and AJ will be playtesting a game that I'm currently writing called Dreadnought that is all about building a queer utopia amongst the stars, while also engaging with themes of, like, the way that we interact with our other selves, with our inner life and how that interacts with our presentation in really fun ways. It's a mix of a Powered by the Apocalypse system and a 52-card deck combined together to simulate, like, two levels of interaction. So, yeah, that's the thing we're doing. I'm really, really excited. Telling an interesting story so far.
Tell me a little bit about, it's Powered by the Apocalypse and there's a deck. Does that mean you're rolling dice and drawing cards, or have you, like, replaced dice with cards completely?
No. So there's two separate systems. There is the on-the-ground system. So, like, when you're, say you're a player and you're, like, doing a thing in physical space, your PC is going around, like, pushing over a cabinet for some reason, you would roll traditionally. But when interacting on this other scale using your other self, you use the card system. And your other self is setting agnostic. In our setting, that means giant robots, because I'm that person who loves giant robots.
That's fair.
A good way to think about it is if you've ever played the Persona series of video games, your other self is akin to your persona. It is a different way of interacting with the world, and they use the 52-card deck. Two of them, actually.
So it's in person mode, you're rolling dice. In mech mode, you're doing cards.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yeah, each suit represents a different way of interacting with the world. So, for example, it's swords, hands, rivers, and tomes. So swords is interacting with the world through physical force, through pressure. Rivers is interacting with the world through grace, precision, accuracy. Hands is communication, teamwork, talking to someone while in your mech. And then tomes is your ability to analyze a situation and use non-physical means of interaction. So, like, hacking, analyzing, stuff like that.
So is it I'm flipping the top card off the deck, or you have a hand?
You have a hand. So your stats for your other self determine your hand. So, for example, I'll pull up one of my players' books right now, their character sheets. So, for example, my player, AJ, whose first session we just did, they are playing a character who has an other self named La Ferveur, which is a really dumb French pun.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that is a very dumb French pun.
Their stats are 1 in swords, 1 in hands, 2 in rivers, and 2 in tomes. the number of stats you have, number of points you have in any stat, is how many cards from that suit you can hold in your hand.
Oh, so you're drawing from like four different decks. Each one is a suit.
Yes.
Interesting.
And the GM can customize and weight those decks depending on the encounter. So depending on the rhythm and intensity of the encounter, you can put in different cards in order to change the dynamics.
Huh. Does every player have two decks, or is it just two regular decks? And so, like, if there are no more swords on the table, then there are no more swords on the table.
If there are no more swords on the table, actually, that ends the scene. And it is basically part of the design ethos that if you are going for so long that you will go through every single card in any given suit, that means that something's probably gone wrong. And that you're, like, leaning into one type of storytelling way too hard, you know? Because you want to, like, diversify the way you interact with your storytelling. So it encourages you to use all of the suits. Because if you run out of any one, that means the encounter is over.
Huh.
Prematurely.
So, okay. Just because this is weird.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say that right now. Like, as a game design mechanic, it's weird. I like it. Because in Powered by the Apocalypse, you don't actually have that much control over what happens. You don't have much control over the intensity of how things happen. Mm-hmm. Terribly well, because the dice determine that.
Right.
I find the ability to change the number pool, like being able to say, okay, I have made these decks for this encounter. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very thought-provoking encounter. There's more tones.
Right.
Than anything else. So, like, that's what you want to prioritize. And I've weighted them so that they're higher cards or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting that you can set up the randomness of an encounter.
Yeah, it's really fun because we did a playtest of it, and it ends up because the GM also has a set of cards. They also have their own hand of cards. Mm-hmm. And it basically means that players and GM have almost equal narrative control in a scene. Once you're in a scene, a player and a GM both have equal narrative control. But before the scene, the GM can stack the deck and kind of tailor it to a specific theme or a specific rhythm of play. Because you can take cards out as the GM. So you have to have one copy of every card from each suit. And you split them up into four decks. So you have to have at least one copy of each card. It's the second copy where things get interesting. You can put in, so for example, you can choose to put in two kings. And the way that the system works is the higher the difference between two cards played, the higher the effect level. So for example, if I as the GM play a 6 and the player responds with a 9, that's level 2 effect because they're separated by a degree of 3, if that follows.
Interesting. Yeah. I'm actually very curious to see how this works at some point.
Yeah. I can see the, like, wheels in Ethan's brain, like, ticking. Also, Ethan, you were telling me just the other day that you wanted to, like, find a game that played a little bit like Persona, so...
I do enjoy Persona.
Yeah, I've actually just been going through Persona 3 right now. It's in my PS Vita because the year is 2013. Oh, that poor system didn't get a chance.
I liked P3P. Like, a lot of people didn't because they took out all the animated cutscenes, but I actually really liked it because the lady character...
Yeah, she's so good.
She's so much better. She actually has personality.
Yeah, I like playing as her. Like, I don't like playing as male characters in general. Because that's the person that I am, but...
She actually enjoys hanging out with her friends.
Yeah! She's, like, bubbly and, like, has feelings.
It's so weird.
Yeah, like, when I play the game, I'm like, oh, this person is nice to people.
Yeah.
And, like, enjoys their company.
Having played the original, because in the original Persona 3, you play as a guy who just doesn't care.
Yeah.
It's part of the theme of the story, but it's really boring. Like, it's not great.
He looks like an absolute edgelord. I've never actually played as the male protagonist. I've only ever had P3P, and I was just like, nah, she seems nice. This dude just seems kind of edgy.
Anytime you're given three options, I think there was always a dot, dot, dot to say nothing.
Yeah, no, fuck that. Like, if I met the Persona 3 male protagonist, I might push him down in public.
It's really funny because they make fun of that a lot in Persona Q.
Yeah, I actually was playing through Persona Q before I did 3, and then I was like, this is probably going to spoil it, so I went back to 3. And it's probably actually, I prefer it to 4. I'll say it.
I have no opinion about the Persona series because...
You've not played them?
I was never a PlayStation person. Like, I've always been a Nintendo house.
Mm-hmm.
So I never got on the Persona train.
I mean, they're making number 5 for the Switch.
They have to. They haven't announced it, but they have to.
No, he's in Joker's in Smash.
Right, Joker's in Smash, but people keep saying to me, like, oh, that doesn't actually mean anything, but those people are goddamn fools. It does mean something. Thank you very much. The good man is gonna be in the video game, so his video game's gonna come to the system.
It's true. I mean, I think that's how Smash works, is you have to have had your character in a Nintendo system.
Yeah.
Wait. Does that mean potentially Dark Souls characters in Smash? Solaire for Smash, please.
Solaire has a statue in Smash.
Well, that's different. I want Solaire.
They're gonna do it.
I want to praise the sun in battle.
I'm sure DLC.
Yeah, Solaire for Smash.
Yeah, Reggie wouldn't let us down like that.
So this is the system that you're playing in. It's an actual play, but it's also a playtest. How do you find that has that changed your playtest process at all?
It has a little bit. So the first time I ever playtested the game, right, I playtested the Other Self system with my friends Kai and Takuma, and it was like a 2-hour long thing all of only the Other Self system, and it was really fun. Like, it, that's when I realized I made a good thing. Maybe I might have made a good thing was when we played for 2 hours and we're like, oh, that didn't feel like that time was that, and instead it was just really cool. So then I just decided, like, what if all of our playtest was recorded as a show, both to like get the word out there about the show and also to like experience it and like maybe create a community around this as it builds. So it has become like basically our sole playtest space. If other people would like to playtest it, that's fantastic. Once it gets to a point where I'm ready to show it to other people who aren't my close good friends.
This happened in our last episode too. Having a let's play of the game you're developing seems like a very strong choice. People want to see something in action, right? Because there are literally too many RPGs.
Yeah.
There's so many. So it's nice to see it in action to see whether or not you would enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Especially when you say, oh yeah, it's played by the Apocalypse and also has a deck of cards.
The other thing that I didn't get a chance to mention actually about the deck of cards is as the players progress, they then begin to acquire control over how the deck is stacked as well. So that is a method of character progression, is you lock cards in so the GM can no longer remove them.
Oh my god, I love that.
Yeah, and then they get bonuses. So the initial way it works is the ace system. So as opposed to regular critical hits, you instead have aces. In each other self is an ace of something. The ace of swords, the ace of hands, the ace of rivers, the ace of tones, etc. There will always be two copies of the ace in any deck because you are there. Your other self is there. And because of that, you have that. And as you develop, you can then lock in the king, the queen, and the jack of any suit you would like. And each of these critical hits has a different effect that develops over time and makes them like not only do you lock this card in, you also have like a special way to use it that no one else can.
Oh my god, I love that.
So for example, the Ace of Tomes gives you +3 effect level, which is the second highest, and the GM reveals their hand to the players. The user of the Ace of Tomes can pick any one card to take from the GM in exchange for their own.
So now you're appealing to the part of me that enjoys Magic the Gathering. Randomness in games is very important. That's just how we think about games, especially TTRPGs. It needs randomness in some way. The idea that you can start altering the randomness, like you can do it in dice, but it's not very interesting because you just add numbers to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting because you're actually changing the availability of certain outcomes.
Yeah, the way that probability tweaks with this is kind of buck wild if you would like do the math.
Which Ethan is going to do the math.
Yeah, if you do the math, you'll find that, like, the way that probability shifts is, like, kind of obscene.
Yes, 100%. No, I've already done this math.
And also, what ties into this is the way that you would, like, stack the deck for a given encounter, and the ways that, like, effect levels work. So, for example, level 0 is a perfect tie, level 1 is 1 to 2 degrees of separation, 3 to 5 is level 2, and 6 plus degrees of separation is level 3. And then you have the level 4, which is 6 plus degrees of separation, combined with an assist or a suit mismatch. So when I say an astute mismatch, the way it works is if someone plays swords, if you respond with hands, you take an effect level lower. So, for example, the GM plays the 6 of swords. and if you respond with a 7 of hands, normally you'd win that encounter, because you have 1 degree of level higher. Instead, you're reduced to a perfect tie.
Basically, if you're defending, you want to play the same type.
Right, but there's also assists, because there's the really frustrating thing of playing tabletop RPGs, wherein sometimes you just get a shit roll and have a really good idea and you're kind of just screwed. Or you have the issue with card games, where you're just dealt a bad hand. And I didn't want that to feel terrible. I never want a player to have a hand where they feel like they can't interact with the story in an interesting way. So the way that an assist works is, a player can burn a card from a suit to raise someone else's effect level by 1. So the player who's assisting has to use the attacking suit. So for example, the GM plays swords, the defender responds with hands. If another player spends a sword card, doesn't matter if it's the 2 or the king, it still raises the effect level by 1.
Oh, so if you have a lower hand, you're very good at helping out.
Exactly. So you can still support the people around you.
Interesting. No, this is actually, you made a really good system. Like, just on the theory, I really like this.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
There's also the fact that if you want to just play straight up making the smartest decision possible, you can do that. If you also want to lean into playing characters, that is also just as encouraged. Because sometimes you have the 8 in your hand, and the GM plays, the 4, and you can get that level 2 effect. But it's more interesting if you don't. That's not what your character do, so you would play the suit mismatch. You always have the option to make the bad decision, if that's what's the interesting decision.
You have narrative control.
Right, because that's the whole thing. Once you're in that stage, once you are using your other self, you have just as much narrative control as the GM.
As opposed to the Powered by the Apocalypse stage, which you are bound by the fates of dice.
Right, you're bound by the way the world works. You have to exist within the world, but your other self is larger than life. It is a way for you to interact with the world in a completely new way. In more metaphorical way, based on the way that other selves are used in fiction, and the interest that I have in things like Persona or stands from JoJo as narrative devices. Because there's definitely something really interesting there with externalizations of the internal self. That's like a really fascinating idea to me, and like making that mechanical, making that physical is like something I'm really excited about.
This sounds like a lot of math to me, but I feel like that's...
It's really not. In play, there's, like, no math.
Yeah, I feel like in play it would make a lot more sense, because you're just like, oh, this card works with this, but yeah. But it does really sound like you've made, like, Ethan's ideal game.
It's interesting, because it's both a randomness game and a resource game.
Yeah.
And I love resource games.
And the way you do assists also does spend a resource. And that resource is based not only on, well, it's the resource of the card, and also a resource of that is based upon the bonds you have with your fellow players. So depending on how many bonds you have completed, you can have more or less of those assists per person, if that follows.
The amount of times you can help people is connected to the level of bond that they have.
Right. How many times you've completed a bond with them, or, because this game has a downtime system, because I'm really interested in downtime and community building, if you choose to spend time with another player during downtime, you get a boost to that. So, for example, if you have a really, like, sweet scene of two characters getting coffee together, next time you're in your other self, you can help them one more time. Because you're just that little bit closer to them.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah, because in downtime, I want to encourage 2 things. 1, community building, because this is a game about building community. And 2, self-care, and learning how to cool down. So in downtime, you have 2 actions you can do. And if you spend both of them on community building, you go into the next session, like, at a disadvantage. You are actively, you roll worse. You know, you have a -1 forward for a while because you are tired. You didn't give yourself that time to rest, that time to gather yourself together. Once again, it's calling back to Persona. You know, if you go to Tartarus every night in Persona 3, then you get tired, and then you can no longer do your schoolwork. It's all about finding that balance of social interaction and changing the world, whether it be through small ways or big ways.
And sometimes you need to change the world at the risk of yourself, but you shouldn't do it too much. This reminds me of a lot of, hashtag play mouse guard, but like when when it comes to the player's turn and you have a limited number of checks and you're like, well, I could advance the story,
or I could just roll to get rid of all of these conditions. And maybe advancing the story is going to make things more interesting, but then you go into the next GM's turn, like, rolling at a disadvantage, so.
Sick and angry and...
Yeah. So tell us about this queer utopia that you are building in Whispers in the Shade.
So we first started with a game of Microscope, which is by, oh, I should know who Microscope is by because I've played it so many times.
Ben Robbins,
yes, thank you. I just pulled up the website. I am a fool, and I apologize for that. Microscope is a fantastic game. I don't know if either of you have ever played it. It is a phenomenal world-building tool. I've had some really good experiences with it, and then a god-awful experience at a convention because straight men. No offense. To anyone listening, or, yeah, I don't know, that's that. He was the primary issue. Do you mind if I have a digression into, like, etiquette of treating other human beings well?
Oh, please.
Hey, if you're at a con game and you're running it, and one of the players seems, like, really uncomfortable and kind of upset, don't write her a note saying you're really pretty.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Also, we were like, hey, you know what we're not interested in engaging with this game? Colonialism. Because, like, that's not a thing we feel, A, equipped to deal with, or B, nor do we want to deal with it in this con game. I don't want to play that in this convention game right now, because I take that very seriously and do not want to be doing that level of thought right now. And then the GM was like, so there are golems in this setting, to which my close good friend Kai, who is Jewish, was like, maybe not those. And then the game turned about to be colonialism, and we were like, ah, good. Glad to see none of the things we said were listened to. You harassed our close good friend. So yeah, that game was terrible. But Microscope the game is fantastic.
That doesn't sound like the game's fault.
No, not at all. No.
That sounds 100% like that one person's fault.
Exactly. The game is fantastic. It is the best world-building tool I've ever used. Basically, one starts off with a palette of things they are interested in talking about and things they are not interested in talking about in their setting. So, do you mind if I read that off for hours real quick?
Yes, please.
Okay. Well, one, the document begins for our Microscope game with just the word delicious. So, shout out to that. Then, slorp. Followed by, no slorp for me, thanks. Followed by slorp. Followed by slorp in a different font. So, in the yes column for what we are interested in talking about is giant robots.
Okay.
Lots of new genders. Lots of new birds. And complex sigil-based magic.
Okay.
Have you seen the show Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood or Full Metal Alchemist?
I've watched bits of the not Brotherhood.
Okay. So you know how transmutation circles look? Where it's like a complex series of like matrix of like lines and symbols and stuff like that?
Right, yeah. Magic circle-y stuff.
Right. So what if those in fiction didn't take like 2 seconds to draw? What if it actually took like 45 hours of really detailed research followed by like 5 of like really detail-oriented drawing? So, like, you can do a lot of, like, really complicated and interesting things, but it takes you a lot of time, which is why the magic stat in setting is also the manual labor stat, because the stats are weird and interesting. But things we weren't interested in our setting was airships, because they're, like, spaceships, but more colonialist.
Okay.
We said no to guns because we throw jav here, which came from a very specific moment in my life when I was walking through my college cafeteria, and I listened to a guy go, yeah, I was talking to this girl recently, she's on the track team, and this other guy goes, no you weren't, man, she's gay, and he goes, what, how do you know, and the guy just responds, she throws jav, man, in reference to javelin. And then I went on to an LGBT conference in Pennsylvania, and I told that story in the van ride up there, and then the girl sitting in front of me whips around while cuddling her girlfriend and is like, wait a minute, that's me! I'm the girl who throws jav! And it was the best moment of my life. So we were like, no guns, because, well, for 2 reasons. One, because guns in fiction are, like, pretty done. You know, giant robots with guns is, like, a common thing. And so is giant robots with swords, but guns are more common. And also because, in setting, it's a lot more interesting if violence is always physical. That you always have to be close. There is an intimacy to it, as opposed to a separation. Because in fiction where there are guns, there are degrees of separation. You know, the metaphors can kind of fall apart because of the physical distance. So we thought it'd be a lot more interesting if there was always had to be a physical act. There's a difference between pulling a trigger and throwing something. One is much more physical and requires a lot more commitment. So we wanted to encourage any form of violence to feel committal, to feel weighty, in a way that pulling a trigger does.
Okay.
We also said no grimdark. So, like, we don't want this story to be about nihilism. We don't want leaning too hard into the gross parts of cyberpunk. And lastly on this list is no anime, which is bracketed as important. No rule breaking. Which is really good because most of what inspired this game is anime. So we're not sticking to that. We're shitposting.
Can you have giant robots without anime?
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, how do you not have anime?
No, we have so much anime already, it's not even funny. One of our characters is a fucking shonen protagonist.
The more I play TTRPGs, the more I think that they're all just anime.
Yeah, no, they are.
Maybe that's just who I play with, but I think they're all just anime.
Okay, so Microscope, it's very interesting because you have, like, a built-in safety tool mechanism.
Yes!
These are hard lines. We don't want to talk about this stuff. Except you did talk about anime.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say the bracketed made it sound more like a joke.
Yes, it is 100% a joke.
Yeah.
You put bracket important.
Yeah.
It's probably not.
No, it's not.
But that, to me, that's very interesting because in a world-building game, you are responsible for building a world, which can literally go in any way. So having both the things you want to talk about and the things you do not seem very directed, which is important in a game where you're literally building from nothing.
Yeah, it's really fantastic, which is why when that game went bad, I was so sad because, like, that was clearly the person in charge not sticking to the thing we all agreed on. And, you know, it does show that even when games are designed to have safety tools built in, those can still fail when players are going with bad faith or are not as invested in those safety tools as others, which I think is an important thing to talk about in games, and, like, talking about how we have to make safety tools things that even someone going in with bad faith will have to adhere to.
It's also, it really drives home the fact that, like, safety tools don't matter depending on the person. And so, like, they're just band-aids, but you gotta trust the people that you're playing with to use the safety tools, or else what's the point?
You have to trust the band-aid.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is part of why when I release Dreadnought, I want to, like, have a section of the book where it's like, hey, listen, if you're gonna tell a story about neo-Nazis and, like, being neo-Nazis, do not use my fucking game. Sorry, I said the swear again. Dang it! If you want to tell a story about neo-Nazis, do not play this game. Because this is not what this is about. You are not who this is about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a game about people who are desperate and people who have been scared for a long time finally getting the chance to build something and change the world that they live in. So that's the first part of Microscope, is you, like, build your palette, I guess, is what it's called. And then you go through and fill the world with periods, which is, like, time periods, and then events, which are nested within periods, and then scenes, which are actually acted out interactions you have within any given event. So there's, like, three scales of play: the massive time scale, the specific event scale, and then the individual character scale.
That's why it's called Microscope.
Exactly. Yeah. It's such a good system.
This reminds me a lot of the Legacy system too, where you have that, like, those different phases of play where you're playing this one huge clan, but then also you're zooming into, like, specific members of this clan and seeing what they're doing, and then onto their grandchildren and all of that stuff. So yeah, give me some specifics about this world that you built using Microscope. So there's obviously giant robots
and magic
and slorp.
Yes, there is magic. So
can we not use slorp and magic in the same sentence?
I mean, sometimes you gotta use your slorp magic to make a black hole.
Slorping magic giant robots.
Slorping magic sounds like you're literally consuming magic, like in the soup, you're just, like, slurping up that magic.
I imagine, like, a giant robot just drinking a can covered in sigils.
Glug glug.
Powered by slorp.
So I guess I can talk about
sorry
no it's a very funny thing we've said. So I guess the overall setting, the major players in it are the Dreadnought itself. So this planet was about to blow up, and all the people there boarded all of these massive ships and flew away. And it started out as a ginormous fleet. And little by little, over the course of centuries and then millennia, all of the other ships have left. All that remains is the Dreadnought itself. And its population is only a fraction of what it could be. This is a ship designed to fit at least 10 million people. Currently, there are about 2, and they're all localized towards the front of the ship. So we have an interesting thing of being a space faction and a spacefaring faction in this game, but inside our actual home and the actual setting, there is this unexplored space because it's only been 2 million people for several hundred years, and nature has not retaken, but has taken the other parts of the ship. Often the theme of nature retaking what once was nature. And instead, we're talking about nature having taken something that was never nature, was never natural, and forcing it into some strange and new form. So there is, like, a major city, and then the rest of the ship is mostly uninhabited, and now unexplored.
Space forest.
Yeah, there is a space forest. There's actually 2 major space forests, and fun fact, our character solo episodes, 2 of them take place in 2 different space forests.
Ooh.
That's a bit of a preview. Wow.
Exclusive content.
Yeah. You heard it here first on Too Many RPGs. Space forests.
Yeah, and then the overall setting is basically, there are a couple major factions. For example, the Serotony, which is a really good word if you've never heard it. Serotony is an ecological adaptation exhibited by some seed plants in which seed release occurs in response to an environmental trigger.
Oh, like jack pine cones.
Exactly. So like, I forget the name of them, but when you touch them, the seeds go shooting everywhere.
We always called them touch-me-nots, honestly.
That sounds like a good name for something that, when you touch it, explodes into seeds.
Yeah. So that's the word Serotony, and that is an ever-expanding, like, type of plant life that can exist in the vacuum of space. And the little bit of flavor text I have in my personal GM document is, Ivy stitches the dead metal together. Grow.
Ooh. That's very aesthetic, honestly.
Yeah. There's also The Without, and this was written by AJ, who is, they are a master of world building and creating interesting factions. We thought them refugees, but they will not cross our threshold, even with an invitation. We watched them wither, empty-bellied, as they vined around our space. They would not reach out a palm or raise a voice, but they met our gaze intently, lips tight, eyes hungry. When we offered help, they would not hear us. When we approached them, they kept their distance intact, cared for it like a loved one. But when we left our help behind, it became theirs in an instant. It is not the feeding they avoid, but the hand.
Huh.
Yeah, shout out to my players who are all, like, phenomenal writers. Side note.
I'm scared of them.
Yeah, so am I.
Not your players, just, like, whatever that is.
Yeah, same. They're terrifying. Also, Dreadnought is a society that is on the... It was at one point fascist. There was a time period wherein Dreadnought was run by fascists. They were known as the Vanguard. Their full name being Clune's Vanguard, based off of the microscope document. Because in our very first scene, we had a character by the name of Elder Clune, and we decided that hundreds of years later, Z had started this fascist vanguard that spiraled out of control, and Z's child, Tourmaline, was the first member of this group, and later would try and atone for their sins by creating a new group, the Knights Tourmaline. But yeah, so there's a lot of weird stuff and interrogations of fascism and what it means to be in a society that has done terrible things and engaging with that.
That's super interesting. And so, you know, I feel like this microscope, you were talking about microscope, and this interview is kind of going like a microscope because we're like, let's talk about the system. Now let's talk about the world. Let's zoom in a little more. Tell me about your players and their characters.
I'd love to, because the people I work with are very cool and creative, and I get very excited about them. So we have my friends AJ, Takuma, and Kai, all of whom use they, them, because my podcast is made up entirely of non-binary people, because I live in an echo chamber. So if I pull up our character sheets for my friend Kai, we have their character, Sigil. is the name they are called, but their full name is Zinnia Astere, and they are playing the playbook The Runner. Their character is a botanist, who are a group of people who, as opposed to modifying their bodies through cybernetics, they use plant life. They became phenomenal at biology, and there's, for example, Zinnia Astere is a mixture of this sculpted chrome, because there is both traditional technology and also sigil magic. So some people have limbs made out of flowing chrome, because the way that sigils most best work is on this specific type of metal that allows it to move like liquid, like skin. And Zinnia's other self is a mech called the Evergarden, which is, imagine if a greenhouse could walk. So it is like the inside. Are you familiar with the mythological creature, a treant?
Yes.
What if a treant lived inside of a greenhouse and that was its armor?
Okay.
So like all of its limbs are encased in glass, and the Evergarden is really cool because it can shift between basically two forms. This form that is slow and powerful and beautiful, or it can break the glass and become grace itself. This giant moving plant mass of twisted vines and roots and trunks. Yeah, I'm really excited by all my player characters, so I'm smiling a lot right now.
And for those at home, Zinnia Astere is actually, it's a kind of flower.
Yes.
They're big, poofy, petaled flowers.
All of our character names are actually related to flowers.
I love that.
Yeah, one of them is a really complicated Japanese pun. So...
is that Takuma?
Yes, it is. Yes, Takuma's a fantastic person.
Yes, they really are.
So, AJ is playing undefeated Marigold Tusk, and their naming convention is really, really cool. AJ developed it themselves. It is three names, all of which are of equal weight. So, undefeated is as much of air name as Marigold, as much of their name is Tusk. You have your Flecked name, which is a name you take from someone you care about. Your Fill name, a name given to you by someone you're close to. And then your Found name, which is a name you give yourself. So AJ's character's name is Undefeated Marigold Tusk, and AR a Sheer, which is a specific gender in our setting, because when we said lots of new genders, we wanted to commit to that and lean into that. So their pronouns are AE, AER, AERS, AERSELF. So heirs, airself.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and A is a maska, which in our setting is a mask that retains memory. So effectively, when you put on this mask on a person, their consciousness is mixed with the existing consciousnesses within the mask. When you take the mask off, that person dies, but they live on in the mask. The maska are a composite people, built up of the emotions and memories and thoughts of dozens of people all put together.
This is very Legend of Zelda to me.
Yeah, that's actually a huge inspiration for Kai. And furthermore, they are receptacles of folk memory. So they effectively become these folk tellers. They know all of the stories because they have lived them. However, with every death, there is a chance that they forget everything, and you never know on which death you will forget. It could be your first, it could be your 30th. So AJ is playing a maska who has just lost all of air memories, and is now has had to be raised again as a new person. And air other self is La Fervère, which is French. Effie La Fervère is iron, and Vert is glass. So the actual mech's name is the Iron Glass. However, because of AJ's particular accent, of AJ the real human person, they say it fervor, which is how their character sees understands La Fervère to be. The character doesn't recognize La Fervère as La Fervère, the famous mech that everyone knows. They see them as embodying fervor, the ideal, because my players are really cool and think of good, smart things. And AJ is playing the Mismatched, which is probably the most unique playbook for the system, and I can wrap back around to that after talking about Takuma's character, because those two playbooks are actually the opposites of each other. Takuma is playing Face the Morning, who uses on and ons pronouns, which are French pronouns, actually, and are actually really effective, and we should use them in English.
I agree. It's a good pronoun. I remember learning French. I'm from Canada, so we have to learn French, like, as soon as we learn to talk. Well, not really, but, like, there is some state-mandated French lessons, and all was always the hardest one to understand, because it's there is really no English thing, but it's a very good pronoun to like to use.
Yeah, and to make a to take a quick diatribe in the language real quick, it's so interesting because even objects are gendered, but people have the option of not being so in the French language, which is such an interesting idea to me, because even in a gendered language, you can take that away when it comes to people. There is that other option baked into the language itself. So clearly someone had to have thought about that for a very long time, and then the dismissal of non-binary gender is completely nonsense, because language intersects with the way we think. And the fact that it's always been a part of the language means that to some degree that has always been part of the way that people in France have thought. Sorry.
And that's actually bigger than that, because German also has a third option.
Exactly.
For things.
Plenty of languages do. You know, it's just English is the odd one out. With the death of singular they several centuries ago, and followed by the rebirth of singular they now.
Right.
Yeah.
But to stop talking about the intricacy of language.
It's a whole different podcast, which, you know, you should go listen to.
Too many words?
Too many words. There's some good language podcasts that you should listen to out there.
I'm trying to think.
There's an NPR one that's like amazing that I'm trying to remember the name of. But anyway, look it up. Google it. NPR language podcast. It's real good.
I'm an English major. I love words.
Words are real good. Anyway, tell us about, oh gosh, morning, face the morning.
Face the morning, which is a Japanese pun because, let me pull up the explanation that Takuma gave. The characters for morning glory are asagao, morning, and face, which face the morning. So it is a play on morning glory, the flower.
Yeah.
Which nothing but respect to my players. And Takuma's character is actually the least nailed down right now. Because of the very specific way that Takuma plays their characters. So I actually have the least to say about them, other than I can give you an idea of what all looks like. Are you familiar with the character Kamen Rider, or Kamen Rider?
What is that from? What?
From the show Kamen Rider. Just imagine, like, a Power Ranger. Power Ranger Ninja Storm Green.
Okay.
So, like, their character, Face the Morning, wears an old suit of Vanguard armor that was left in the forest for about 500 years. So it's this barely functioning suit of old armor from the old regime. And Aung's other self is Mama Bear. And there is a very specific mech from Gundam called a Bear Guy, and okay. I'm gonna send y'all a picture of Bear Guy F.
Yes.
And I'm really really copy image friends. Here you go.
Oh my god. Oh,
this is from a Gundam.
Yes.
I love them.
So Bear Guy F. Home. They're just like cartoon teddy bears, but what if they were giant robots capable of murder? So the big one, her name is Mama Bear, and the little one doesn't have a name yet. And that's as much as I can really say about Takuma's character right now, because they like to explore their characters through play, as opposed to giving them traits beforehand. Because Takuma is a genius and a phenomenal player.
Isn't Gundam a story about, like, military conquest?
Yeah.
Like...
yeah, with children. So that's from a specific series called Gundam Build Fighters, which is designed to sell toys, but is a surprisingly good TV show.
Okay.
And Face the Morning's playbook is the actualized. So the playbooks in the setting, in the game, are the heart, the mismatched, the artist, the runner, the presence, and the actualized. And so I'm only going to talk about the ones that we have in the game, so it doesn't take 9 hours.
Perfect.
The mismatched and the actualized are both defined by their relationship to their other selves. So, for example, the basic move of the mismatched, who AJ is playing, is called discordant. Also, all of the mismatched moves are named after musical concepts. So discordant, homophonic, aria, and cadenza. So far, your other self feels so different from you. It's like the world was trying to play a cruel joke. The others mesh so well with theirs, but you seem to stand out. When your back is against the wall, though, it's always there. So do you accept its help or push it away? In exchange for reducing one of your other self stats by 1, you can add a +1 to any roll. You cannot lower a stat below 1. You can also take a -2 on a roll once per session and give your other self a +1 to any one of its stats. So the mismatch is all about sacrificing either your other self or your actual self to support the other.
Interesting.
And give one more control.
You're basically, like, giving up parts of yourself to power up the other one because you are mismatched. So you have to, like, do you give in or do you stay yourself?
Exactly. And then also they have moves like homophonic. You and your other self can operate independently of each other more than anyone anyone else. Disregard the penalty to roles normally taken when utilizing your other self. It's up to you to find who really carries the melody. So normally, if you wanted to use a regular move while operating your other self, you have to take a minus one to that role, mm-hmm. because that's difficult to operate on two levels of being at the same time. But the mismatched can do it better than anyone else because they're so out of sync. They can work together really well.
Oh, that's super cool. So, because I, for a second, I was like, why is it homophonic instead of polyphonic? Because it's, to me, like, the polyphony of it is, like, these two independent lines coming together to create something bigger. But because of the way the mismatch works, the homophonic line is, like, it's trying to figure out, like, which one is the chordal structure that is supporting the... Oh, that's very cool. Sorry. Ethan got to do his math thing. I got to do my music thing. Okay.
Lauren does opera.
Oh, then you're gonna love aria.
Yeah, I was like, please tell me. I didn't want to just like, yeah, tell me about the aria move, but like, please tell me about the aria move.
You and your other self have never gotten along, which is why you needed to learn how to find time to talk, even the most high intensity circumstances. You may now bring yourself and one other person alongside your other self into a self-contained space where you have up to 10 minutes to communicate without time outside the space passing more than a few seconds.
Gosh, I love that so much. That's so good. Oh my god.
So you can create like a bubble of time where you and someone else can all talk to each other, even when the situation would not normally allow it, because you had to learn how to do so to interact with your other self at all.
That's very, very good.
Yep, and you know what? Just, I'll do the last music thing.
Please tell me.
Cadenza. You've lived in your other self's shadow your whole life. When performing a task you're skilled at, you can roll plus stat. On a 10+, you do something incredibly effective and flashy. Everyone sees you for what you're really capable of. On a 7-9, you look incredibly cool. Everyone focuses on you, but the effect is only a fraction of what you desired. Do you finish the job and reveal your ruse, or move on hoping you did just enough? So you, no matter what, you look really cool, but whether or not you actually did the thing well enough is dependent on whether you rolled a 7-9 or a 10+. So you can expose the fact that you were faking and that you didn't actually do it, and everyone knows what you did, but you save them and you actually do the thing. Or you can choose to lean into the facade of it and make everyone think that you're really, really cool while not being effective enough. The Mismatched is a lot about dealing with anxiety and imposter syndrome as a like playbook concept.
Which is so good for just having it all music based, because that's just the life of mm-hmm. a musician.
Yep. Yep. So it's all about learning to deal with anxiety and imposter syndrome and trying to find oneself in the face of expectations.
All right. And so that's AJ's character.
Yes.
Is the Mismatched. And Takuma's character is the Actualized, which is,
right,
I guess, the opposite. They're like super in tune with their other self.
Which is a bear.
Yes. Which is really
a cartoon bear.
Which is so interesting because Takuma's character, as they've described it so far, is so radically different from their other self. Which is so interesting that they chose the Actualized of all playbooks. Wild card. You understand your other self better than anyone else. The rest of the team has a relationship with theirs, but you and yours are inseparable. You reflect them, and they reflect you. Draw an additional card when using your other self from whichever suit you choose. So the Actualized always has a 7th stat. So you normally have a maximum stat total of 6. Mm-hmm. The Actualized has 7, and they get to choose whichever suit they'd like. And that can change in the middle of a fight. So you can choose to have your wild card be Rivers at one point, and then Tomes the next.
Okay.
And then Embody. Once per session, you can use any of your other selves' cards in place of rolling 2d6. You may still add the stat bonus as normal. Jack, Queens, and Kings are worth 11, 12, and 13 respectively. Aces are treated as an instant 10+, if they match the suit of your other self. Explain how your connection to your other self allows you to perform this feat. So,
okay,
that actually incorporates the use of cards as opposed to rolling, like you mentioned earlier.
That's, okay. So they're sort of, they can draw on the strengths of each side.
A thing I forgot to mention about the aces, just to jump back to those real quick, is the metaphor behind the ace. For any other self, the ace is the worst card to get. It is the lowest value card in the game, except for the ace of whatever, because in that situation, it's an opportunity that only they would see. So the idea is, when pushed against the wall, When everyone else would be desperate and out of luck, your other self can see the opportunity that no one else could. It's turning a moment of defeat into a moment of victory because of who you are. Because of who you specifically are.
That's very good. The whole thing is very good, but I do like that. And you find that a lot in, like, I stopped watching Voltron after the first season because there was just so much Voltron. But, like, in Voltron, they all had a moment, like, in the first season, they all had a moment like that, right? When they were, like, each different Voltron lion thing, like, all of a sudden got their giant mech gun or whatever that...
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
I know you're trying to say.
It's been so long since I watched it, but there was that moment where it's like, oh, now this person makes a shield because the chips are down. It's very, I can see how you're like, this game is very anime.
Yeah,
but I really like it. I mean, that's a very good trope, and I do really like the way that you have mechanically, like, that like really heavy-handed fail forward where your like crit fail for anybody else is a crit success just for you.
Yeah, they're real fun. I really like the thing. I'm really excited for people to be able to play it. It fills my heart with joy.
Well, it sounds very, very good, so.
The actual basic of the Other Self system was written during the 6-hour drive home from Gen Con, because I was just by myself in a car, and I kind of just let my mind wander, and then I wrote basically everything about the Other Self system on that drive home, and then just typed it all out, and it's what I've been rolling with since.
Nice.
Yeah.
So yeah, shout out to Gen Con. I'd recommend going if you ever can. It's a really, really fun time.
Do we want to move on to the final question?
The final question, yes.
Hit me.
So, fill in the blank.
Okay.
If you like blank, you'll like Whispers in Shade.
Do you want a real answer or a joke answer?
Both.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, deliquous. Okay.
Swears.
I'm trying to, like, distill it into a phrase, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you like teens and giant robots learning to love themselves amongst the stars, then you'll really like Whispers in the Shade, I hope.
Nice.
Yes.
And actually, would you mind if I read out, like, the tagline for the game as, like, a final thing?
Oh, yeah, please do. Yeah.
Dread not, our elders told us, for someday we shall shine so brilliantly amongst the stars. And so we set to work, building our home to stand against any tempest, a bluff upon which those vile storms would ever break.
Dreadnought.
Yeah.
A big boat.
Dreadnought. It's like a big boat, but instead of full of guns, it's full of emotions.
That's also a very good tagline. If you're looking for alternate taglines, that one's good.
Fire the mood cannon.
This is our big spaceship full of feelings. Look out.
Super Princess Peach, right? Where she, like, uses her emotions to, like, you know, affect the world around her and, like, destroy enemies and stuff. So it's, it totally works. Shoutouts to Super Princess Peach, by the way. Solid game. If people are listening and are like Ethan and I and are super sold on this concept, super hyped for the game, super hyped for the podcast, how it's not out yet. So how can we find out, you know, when it is?
How can we pre-order this show?
Yeah.
So you can't do this as of the moment we're recording this, but in about 15 minutes, if you go to twitter.com/WITS_show, you will have the Whispers in the Shade Twitter, where updates for the podcast will be announced. And for updates on the game itself, you can follow me on Twitter at Bren or Raven if you want to have a hellscape of slime on your Twitter feed every once in a while.
Okay. I have questions, but okay.
We'll answer them after the show.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. This has been super good.
I'm sorry if I talked too much.
Hellscape of slime. No, it was very good. This was all really fascinating and interesting. And yeah, this sounds like a really cool system. It sounds like you have something super great. So I'm really excited to find out more. And of course, when the episode, or like the first episode, releases out into the world, it will also be on... We will make sure to retweet it on the Too Many RPGs Twitter. So if you follow us on Too Many RPGs, which, I mean, please do if you listen to this podcast, because that's where you find out all of the good stuff about this podcast. You can check there as well. Thank you to Bren for teaching us about giant cartoon bear Gundams, Jeff for writing the music with me, and you, the audience. We hope you enjoyed this episode.
If you did enjoy it, or have a creator in mind that we should contact for future episodes, you can tweet us at TooManyRPGs on Twitter, or you can contact Lauren at JL_NiceGirl,
or Ethan at SuperRobotBear. If you liked this episode, please leave us a review on your favorite podcatcher and recommend us to your friends. It really helps spread the show to new people and get us a better sense of, you know, who's listening and what people like, and that's important for us to make a better podcast.
There's just too many RPGs, but we wouldn't have it any other way!
Okay.
I don't know. It's actually weird to say.
Like, there's just too many RPGs, but we wouldn't have it any other way. Something